Section 20 of Astounding Stories, 14, February 1931, by Various. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Phalanxes of Atlans, by F. V. W. Mason. Chapter 4, Part B. The Law of Atlans, pronounced the Emperor with a frown, states that a stranger must prove his worth to the state, else he must be put to death. Thank thou thy gods that thou hast not fallen into the hands of the lost tribes, for assuredly thou would perish miserably, as must thy comrade. "What is the law of Jarmuth?" inquired Nelson, his mind furiously at work. "Their law states that the stranger within their gates must perish on the altar of Beelzebub, Jarmuth's blood-hungry demon god." A momentary expression of sadness crept into the Emperor's blue eyes, and he beat a square, powerful hand on the arm of his throne. "Aye, blood-hungry, lack-a-day. But yesterday six of our fairest maidens crossed the boiling river, never to return." Nelson was about to speak when from outside came the blast of a trumpet. The assembled Atlanteans started, paused, and remained silent, listening intently. Hero Giles looked up, a light kindling in his deep-set eyes. Yon was an Israelite trumpet. As the words left his lips, there came a hurried rapping at the portal, whereupon the guards sprang forward. "Bid them enter." Altorius seemed strangely tense and uneasy. Quietly the door rolled back as before, revealing an Atlantean, whose eyes rolled with alarm. He hurried forward and flung himself on the floor at the Emperor's sandaled feet. "Hearken, O serene splendor! Waiting without is an embassy from His Majesty of Jarmuth. They bear words for thine Imperial Highness." "Now, by Saturn, here's insolence, at an hour such as this." With a furious swirl of his scarlet cloak, Altorius leaped to his feet, hand on the ivory handle of his sword, which to Nelson's amusement was not of bronze, but of good blue-gray steel. "I'll bet it's old Sir Henry's original pet sticker," he thought. "Bring on these dogs of Israel," growled Altorius. "They shall die." "Gently, gently, O splendor," murmured Hero John. "Our full force is not yet camped on the plains of Poseidon." "Nay, have the rogues flayed alive," was the advice of the hot-headed elder brother. He, like the Emperor, was scowling and livid with fury. Presently there appeared four men, stalwart warriors as totally different in aspect from the Atlanteans as humans might be. The two races were alike only in splendid physical proportions and human figures. They, the Jarmuthians, were black-haired and dark-skinned, whereas the Atlanteans, with the exception of Sir Henry's progeny, were red-headed. Truculently, the half-naked ambassadors strode over the polished floor, which reflected their rude images. Their hairy chests, arms, and legs afforded a sharp contrast to the neat Atlantean nobles, who drew back with expressions of disgust. "Good God!" gasped Nelson in lively surprise. "A bunch of the boys from Seventh Avenue." It was true. Each Jarmuthian clearly betrayed his Hebraic origin in huge fleshy nose and pendulous lower lip, so characteristic of the Semitic race. They were fierce, shaggy fellows, naked from the waist up save for a kind of jointed body armor, reminiscent of a Roman legionnaire's. Their long, abundant blue-black hair was either plaited or flowed uncut over splendidly muscled shoulders. Their beards, on the other hand, were short and frizzed into tight curls, in the Assyrian manner. On each man's head was set a highly polished pointed casque of copper, surmounted in each instance by the six-pointed star of Solomon. Otherwise, the brutal-looking emissaries wore nothing but dirty, food-spotted kilts and rough hide sandals secured by thongs. With all the insolence and self-assurance of conquerors in the presence of slaves, the four jet-eyed ambassadors swaggered up to the diamond throne. Then the foremost briefly inclined his head towards Altorius in a grudging salute and began to speak in deep, resonant tones. From that point Nelson could understand nothing of the conversation as it was carried on in the guttural and unintelligible language of that lost realm. But from time to time Hero John found opportunity to translate an occasional phrase. Darker and darker grew the brows of the gorgeously attired emperor and his eagle-visaged captain-general as they listened to the pompous oratory of the foremost Jarmuthian, and in dark fury more than one Atlantean noble half drew his sword when the speaker fell silent at last. "He said," the younger Atlantean whispered, "that Jeroboam is no longer satisfied with six maidens. Beelzebub demands a further offering of six more damsels to be delivered before the third division of time on the morrow. By Saturn, the insolence of these besotted swine passes all tolerance." From the Atlantean emperor's outraged negative gestures, Nelson surmised that Altorius was making an emphatic refusal and even adding some vicious threat. The foremost Jarmuthian slapped huge dirty hands on armored hips and fell to laughing with an insolence that would have provoked a rabbit. Forgetting dignity and self-control, Altorius, in a single tigerish leap, sprang from his throne and knocked the mocker senseless with a powerful blow to the jaw. Then, spurning the fallen Jarmuthian with a sandaled foot, the Atlantean fixed blazing eyes upon the three other ambassadors, who, nothing daunted, closed up, muttering savagely in their frizzed black beards, while their hands sought the spot where swords would normally have hung. "Nice right to the jaw," commented Nelson with a grin. "He's still English enough to use his fists." He turned to Hero John, who stood with an expression of horror on his comely features. "What caused the row?" "Verily, our plight is grave indeed. That braggart dog threatened to march on Heliopolis in the first division of morning, and..." Hero John's lips compressed into a hopeless, taut expression. "Our reinforcing phalanxes can never arrive in time to defend Cierum at that hour. Should the defense fail, as it must, since they outnumber us 3-1 for the nonce, it would cost us many thousands of men to stay the blood-hungry hordes of Jeroboam once freed on the great plain." Like a star shell bursting on a cloudy night came the inception of an idea. "Here," cried Nelson, "I've an idea. Maybe I can fix a stall until the rest of your boys do a General Phil Sheridan and get here." Hero John's blue eyes widened uncomprehendingly. "What?" he demanded. "What dost thou propose?" Nelson's hand crept to his head, for the unaccustomed weight and heat of the helmet made it itch. "You say these bright boys from over the border want to chow six more girls? Am I right?" "Yea, O friend Nelson, they demand the victims tomorrow morn, else they advance." "All right." Nelson was thinking fast now. A dreadful vision of Richard Alden stretched for sacrifice on the brass altar of Beelzebub ever floating before his aching eyes. "Tell those Semites that they can have those six girls, if they can take them away from me." A puzzled frown creased the younger hero's brow, and he tugged thoughtfully at his scant yellow beard. "Prithee pardon me, but I do not comprehend." "All right, get this now. Tell the Jarmuthians that they can send six of their biggest and best scrappers, one for each girl. If they can take any one of those girls away from me, they can take them all, taking me as well, and we'll get the works in Jezreel together. But on the other hand, if I kill their six champions, then Alden is returned unharmed, the six girls come home, and the six other girls come back too, and there'll be no more hostages. I don't think they'll agree to or even consider surrendering your princess Altera. I'm sorry I can't accomplish that too. But if I can stop this annual tribute, it won't be so bad, will it?" Rounder and rounder grew the Atlantean's eyes, and he gaped like a schoolboy in a sideshow. "What sayest thou? Thou alone to overcome six of their best warriors? Nay, but this is folly. Moonshine, what knowest thou of their weapons?" "Nothing," admitted Nelson, "but I do know Brother Winchester here." He patted the smooth stock. "He's mighty persuasive, properly handled." "But they are armored. They have the fungus bombs, the light retortii, and the javelin." "Righto," agreed Nelson a trifle carelessly. "But you don't know what this old boy can do when he's put to it." "Well?" "By Saturn," an uncertain ring crept into the Atlantean prince's voice. "A moment while I address his splendor." "I'm a fool, a damn fool," thought Nelson. "Still, it's Alden's only chance. Unless the Jarmuthians have got some trick I'm not on to, I ought to stand a fighting chance. Meanwhile, Emperor and Captain General drew to one side, listening to Hero John's impassioned oratory. That the idea met with disapproval, Nelson quietly recognized from the incredulous, even contemptuous, glances Altorius shot at him. Leaving the four sneering Jarmuthians under guard of the nobles, the Emperor came striding impatiently over the inlaid floor. "What madness is this?" he demanded harshly. "Dost thou realize what would hang upon thy skill? If thou shouldst fail, our annual hostage for the divine Altara would be 12 instead of 6 of our maidens. Further, the dog-conceived Jeroboam would wax unbearably overweening and insolent. Nay, there is too much at hazard. Though outnumbered, we will give battle in the morning." "Yes?" demanded Nelson in turn, impatient. "A fine chance you'd stand. Why, less than half your army is here at Cierum, and Hero John tells me that the enemy have massed their entire forces on the salient of Poseidon. Isn't that so?" Altorius's handsome brow darkened. "Aye," he admitted, "but our reinforcing corps will come up before the third hour of the third division." Here Hero Giles broke in, and speaking with the quick, impassioned tones of one whose reactions are violent, pled for confidence in the American. "Nay, fair cousin," he replied, casting a sidewise look at the Jarmuthians standing in muttered colloquy with their leader, who had now gotten to his feet and was angrily dabbing the blood from his chin with the hem of his yellow kilt-like garment. "I saw with mine own eyes what miracles friend Nelson doth perform with his curious noise-making retortii. If Jeroboam falls upon us ere our regiments are marshalled, then verily are we doomed. We have no choice but to play for time. Hearken to the counsel of Hero John. Methinks this stranger from the ice world is no braggart. He will fight well. If he loses, he dies horribly. That he knows. The thought will strengthen his arms, and if he wins..." Then broke in Nelson firmly. "If I win, I must have the word of your majesty that Alden and I are to be afforded all help and free passage to that place where your soldiers captured my friend. Is that understood?" Altorius's blue eyes shifted, and there was a slight hesitation in his manner. Then, coming to a decision, he whirled and extended his hand. "Good. 'Tis agreed," he said. "On my head be it. Have patience while Hero Giles confers with these outlandish dogs." It was with intense interest that the anxious aviator watched the ensuing conference. He could see the four Jarmuthians listening, dark eyes restlessly flitting back and forth, and their mouths twisted into contemptuous half-snarls. Then, as Nelson's offer was made clear, a look of cunning seemed to creep into the eyes of the leader. He asked for clarification of several points. Then, being informed of the details, his thick lips parted in an evil, crafty grin. Taken aback at the suspiciously ready acquiescence of the enemy, Hero Giles turned about. "They agree," he translated, "that should friend Nelson win, they will return to their own land, they will forfeit the annual tribute forever, and return the other stranger unharmed. They speak fair, but I fear..." He bit his lips in perplexity. "These dogs, who talk with the forked tongues of serpents, plan some snare, some cunning trickery." "Repeat the terms." Altorius seemed gripped with apprehension, too. "Let all be clearly understood. At the third division of morning will the wanderer fight 6 warriors, no more and no less." This was agreed and reaffirmed. Then, with an insolent, triumphant laugh, the Jarmuthian delegation whirled about and stalked from the room, their dark, grieved legs flashing in military unison over the polished floor. "'Tis done," quoth Hero Giles gloomily. "The encounter will take place on the plain of Gilboa, at the third hour of the third division. And may Saturn help us if thy might fails, friend Nelson, for then surely will the hordes of Jarmuth despoil us, and there will come a desolation and a darkness upon the empire of Atlans." End of chapter 4, part B. Section 21 of Astounding Stories 14, February 1931, by Various. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Phalanxes of Atlans, by F. V. W. Mason. Chapter 5. It seemed incredibly soon that Victor Nelson found himself striding out from the serrated ranks of the Atlantean army, which, drawn up in a rough diamond formation, looked discouragingly small in comparison to that vast sea of helmets twinkling ominously across the plain of Poseidon amid a haze of bright yellow dust which climbed lazily into the breathless heavens. The Jarmuthian army, numbering perhaps 60 or 70 thousand effective troops, lay encamped in a great salient formed by a convolution of the Apidanus and formed the only Jarmuthian tract of the great valley lying south of the boiling river. Like low-lying snowdrifts, the sheen of the enemy tents struck Nelson's eye as he strode over the bright green turf to battle for Richard Alden's life. There was something back of those nasty grins of the ambassadors, he reflected. I wonder what deviltry they're cooking up. He glanced at a stalwart Atlantean herald who, nervous in the extreme, clutched his brazen dolphin-shaped horn and followed in the American's wake together with a sad little company. Weeping, moaning, and dressed in plain black robes, marched six really lovely girls, they who would perish on Beelzebub's altar if Nelson failed. Bitter were the looks of the guards as they secured the hands of the victims, and many the hopeful look cast at the impassive American when they turned back, leaving the helpless girls to their fate. The ground where the one-sided duel was to take place was marked off by means of little yellow flags on a level plain perhaps a quarter of a mile long and wide. Arriving on the nearest border, Nelson briefly motioned the herald to halt. "Might as well start shooting at the best range possible and beat their steam-throwers," he decided. "Wish to the devil I'd a few more cartridges. Only 13 shots between me and Beelzebub's altar in Jezreel, so I'd better not miss. All right, son, toot your horn." With his thumb he gestured the command, whereupon the Atlantean nodded eagerly and, filling his chest, set horn to lips to blow a long, strident note that rang harshly, boldly out over the great plain. While the note of the challenge rang out, Nelson's eyes turned back to regard the Atlantean array and detected, far in the rear, a huge pillar of dust which must mark the progress of the Atlantean reinforcements. Would they arrive at Cierum in time? Then his eyes sought the spot where Altorius and his staff sat anxiously on their podokos, watching intently the impending struggle. Very clearly the flash of their armor came to him. "I guess, like the girls back there, they're kind of nervous and jumpy," thought Nelson. "Well, I don't blame them. I've had quieter moments myself." Having blown three blasts, the Atlantean herald saluted, then with disconcerting haste made his way back to the ranks of his fellows some 200 yards away. From the Jarmuthian army came an answering blast. Nelson cast a last look on the Atlantean army, breathlessly awaiting the impending duel. There was the Allosauri corps on the far left. He could see the chimeric monster's long, repulsive necks writhing endlessly back and forth through the air as they squealed and tugged strongly at their restraining chains. On the right were stationed perhaps 10,000 Podokesons, their slender, yellow-shafted lances swaying like a sapling forest in the distance. In the center were 11,000 protection infantry, green-crested and armed with compact tanks of blue maxima vapor, fungus bombs, and swords. Behind them, and corresponding to heavy infantry, were ranged some 20,000 blue-plumed hoplites, eagerly fingering the brazen hoses of their death-dealing portable retortii. Nelson had no time to further study the array, for he whirled about as from the Atlantean army arose a deep, horrified shout. He stood paralyzed, his jaw slack. For there, waddling slowly forward, came the most fantastic huge creature imaginable. Unspeakably repellent and horrible, it stood on short legs thick as mature trees, to tower at least 35 feet above the ground at the foreshoulders. An immense reptilian neck, some 25 feet long, waved continuously back and forth, while a surprisingly small, bullet-shaped head emitted rumbling grunts. "Great God!" gasped the horrified aviator, and felt the ground sway under him. "It must be 90 feet long!" Paralyzed by a dreadful fascination, he watched the ungainly, hill-like reptile shuffle ponderously forward, and realized that, high on its back, was fixed a small fort, rather like those howdahs or boxes which are fastened to the backs of elephants. Chilled with the nearness of death, Nelson counted 6 mail-clad warriors in the howdah. Then the true import of the Jarmuthian's evil jest struck him with full force. 6 men, they said, and 6 men there are, but the treacherous devils mounted them on that walking hillside. Guess Altorius can kiss his 6 girls goodbye right now. Poor Alden. Well, I did my best. A rotten trick. At that moment he felt as an ant must feel on beholding the approach of a human. It was terrifying, the inexorable advance of that colossal, fantastic monster. From behind he could hear the infuriated shouts of the Atlantean army. They knew even he could not hope to withstand the murderous onslaught of the beast now entering the dueling space. On came the Diplodocus, its vast warty tail trailing over the ground and raising a heavy column of dust, while its mud-smeared sides bore out Hero Giles' statement that here was one of those semi-aquatic titans from the steaming swamps of Jarmuth. Hell, poor Alden's as good as finished now. What a fool I was to think I could save him. Obedient to an overwhelming fear, Nelson whirled to flee, then stopped as from the depths of his being a stronger power forbade him to desert his friend to certain death. Range 250 yards, he estimated, and whipping up the Winchester, sighted full at the ponderous creature's slimy, snake-like head. When the recoil jarred his shoulder, Nelson dropped the barrel an inch or so to watch. Nothing happened. The great beast was advancing as before, its incredibly long neck weaving steadily back and forth as though to sniff the air. Hell! Struck by a sudden thought, he snatched a cartridge from his pocket, and with that strength which comes to men in their hour of mortal peril, wrenched out the metal-jacketed bullet to reinsert it backwards into the brass cartridge case. Meanwhile the vast brute had drawn nearer, crushing flat a young oak in its path as easily as though it had been a wheat stalk. "Maybe this dum-dum will do some good," panted Nelson. "If it doesn't, nothing will stop it." Again he sighted until, finding those small orange-red eyes in line with his sight, he fired. This time the gray-brown monster uttered a titanic bellow of rage, halted, and began shaking its clumsy, blunt head. "Hit it, by God!" exulted Nelson, and seized the momentary respite to slip 2 fresh cartridges into the Winchester's magazine. But to his inexpressible dismay, the monster presently resumed its ponderous progress, while the Jarmuthians in the howdah uttered taunting yells that reached him faintly, while the sun flares glinted on their brandished swords and lances. One of them plucked a fungus grenade from his belt and flung it with all his might in Nelson's direction. The missile fell to the earth far short of its destination, and seemed to break rather than explode, at the same time expelling that deadly greenish-yellow vapor, which, blown away by a strong wind, fortunately came nowhere near the doomed aviator. "Oh, you will?" Nelson sighted swiftly at the grenade-thrower and fired, whereupon the Jarmuthian, some 150 yards distant, spun crazily about, flung both arms towards the amber-yellow sky, and toppled from the howdah, for all the world like a diver in quest of pearls. From both breathless armies rose a terrific shout. Accustomed as they were to the visible destruction of the retortii, this noisy yet invisible death was appalling. But Nelson's agonized attention was not on the assembled armies, for nearer came the mountainous Diplodocus, its lumbering strides making the howdah sway like a ship in a gale and preventing the use of the portable retortii. Nelson planted both feet, took fresh grip on his waning courage, and shot again, this time aiming at a gigantic black-bearded warrior who seemed to be training one of those portable retortii upon him. Again the Winchester cracked, and this time the black-bearded man sank from sight back into the howdah, while his companions, uttering vengeful shouts, tossed more fungus bombs at the lone heroic figure barring their progress towards the 6 bound and shrieking maidens. Towering thrice as high as the largest African elephant, the Diplodocus was now but 75 yards away. He had hit it, that Nelson could tell, for a large shower of blood sprayed from the monster's neck. Then, uttering a despairing curse, he sent a shot smacking squarely into the left shoulder. At the base of that mast-like neck, with fervent hope of finding the heart, but the heavy bullet bothered the cyclopean reptile no more than a sting of a mosquito. On it came. In another minute it must stamp out Victor Nelson's life beneath feet as large as hogsheads. Damn! Nelson snapped the ejector lever, throwing out the spent cartridge. No use, he whispered. Can't phase that hill of meat, but I might as well kill all of those bloody cannibals I can. With amazing speed and accuracy, he picked off two of the remaining Jarmuthians, whose shining bronze armor could nowise withstand the wicked impact of modern nickel-jacketed bullets. One of the stricken men for a moment dangled with the last of his strength from one of the chains securing the howdah to the enormous creature's back, then tumbled heavily some 40 feet to the earth. Only two shots more in the magazine. Nelson suddenly found himself very cool. Two shots, and then... He was conscious of that great snake-like head darting viciously in his direction. A huge slobbering mouth, studded with teeth a foot long, yawned redly before him like a nightmare incarnate, blotting out consciousness of all else. Then Victor Nelson, fighting to control his strumming nerves, deliberately sighted into a great orange-colored eye, saw the narrow black iris over the Winchester's front sight, and knew the huge warty head was not 10 feet away. He pressed the trigger and never heard the report, but felt the blast of a furnace-hot breath in his face, a breath that stank like the foul reek of burning rubber. With a detached sense of surprise, he saw the eye miraculously and dreadfully disintegrate. Then, as the bitter smell of burned cordite stung his nostrils, he sprang violently sidewise to find himself staring up at the howdah, now towering at least 40 feet above. The next few minutes were indescribable. Horrible roars and bellows, loud as those of a thousand angered bulls, shattered the air. The Diplodocus halted, stunned by pain and the partial loss of eyesight. Then, its infinitesimal brain becoming gripped with fear, it plunged and lumbered sidewise, nearly shaking the warriors from the howdah, where they clung for dear life. Nelson was barely able to avoid the sweep of the powerful tail as the Diplodocus wheeled about on hind legs, reeled and started blindly back towards the Jarmuthian ranks. Suddenly it stood stock still, shaking with super-elephantine motions. Then, for all the worlds like a balky mule, it sank to the earth and cowered there, despite the frantic efforts of the surviving Jarmuthians to stir it to obedience. By the strong amber light of the sun flare, Nelson had a vision of the last two warriors swinging in ape-like agility to the ground. They were giants, those two men of Jarmuth, and their conical helmets added additional stature. One of them, shouting an unintelligible taunt, reached for his belt to snatch out a fungus bomb, but Nelson, dropping on one knee, sent a bullet crashing between the Jarmuthian's scowling eyes. Even as he fell, the last of the six champions unwisely ignored his retortii and frantically sprang forward, razor-edged sword upraised. Nelson frantically worked the ejector lever, but only an empty click resulted. His heart sank. Hell, the magazine's empty. He had just time to swing the Winchester about and grasp its barrel as the Jarmuthian, with a loud shout, sprang in, slashing viciously at Nelson's unprotected neck. Using the clubbed rifle like a baseball bat, the American struck out with the strength of despair. There came a resonant clang as blade and barrel encountered each other. Steel is ever stronger than bronze, so Nelson had the satisfaction of seeing the Jarmuthian's sword blade break squarely in two near the hilt. Horrified, the black-bearded warrior glanced at the empty hilt in his hand, but courageous to the end, sprang in like a tiger to grapple with that small, agile man in khaki and serge. "You would, eh?" gasped Nelson. Putting all his strength behind a blow, he whirled up the heavy Winchester, struck out and felt the solid walnut stock smash fair and square on the conical helmet. Like an eggshell, the bronze helm broke, and the six-pointed star above went spinning off into the dust. As a tree sways before it falls beneath a forester's axe, so the dark Jarmuthian giant tottered, while the wide dusty plain of Poseidon echoed with a rumbling, incredulous shout. "There," choked Nelson, incredulous to be still alive, "I guess that'll be about all for today." But he was wrong. From the ranks of Jarmuth rose a terrible, ominous cry, and at the same time there broke out the sibilant hiss of a thousand retortii. From the Atlantean army came an answering yell, and Nelson turned to race back to the shelter of Altorius's bodyguard, pausing but to arouse the terrified hostages. Swiftly he cast loose their bonds and pointed to the nearest detachment of Atlanteans. Sobbing with joy, the six girls fled for dear life just as the first of the Allosauri went racing over the plains. Screaming, all-powerful and uncanny war-dogs, they bounded grotesquely high in the air, plunging straight towards the Jarmuthian ranks, which greeted them with a searing, billowing blast of their retortii. Though dozens of the terrible creatures fell kicking and writhing beneath the scalding discharge of the retortii, the main body, perhaps 40 or 50 in number, sprang like rending fiends into the dense-packed masses of Jarmuthian infantry. Of the ensuing battle, Nelson had but the most confused recollections. The dominating impression was that the fray was awesome, horrible beyond power of description. He recalled feeding the 5 remaining cartridges into the magazine, then clapping on an Atlantean noble's helmet. With Hero John at his side, he joined in a furious headlong charge of the Potoko Corps. Like a vast glittering wedge, the gallant Atlantean lancers advanced under shelter of the blue maxima vapor, which, discharged by the protectons, or light infantry, dispelled the scalding steam clouds launched from the Jarmuthian portable retortii. "Haller Van!" Hero John shouted the Atlantean war cry. "Haller Van! Come, friend Nelson. This day shall the treacherous swine of Jarmuth drown in their own blood. Haller Van!" Nelson replied nothing. He was too busy drawing a bead on a gorgeously arrayed enemy officer who appeared to be directing the defense. Faster and faster rushed the Podokos, 40, 50 miles an hour, a carnate thunderbolt hurled straight at the enemy center. Under a hot fire of grenades, dozens of the lancers fell, and once, when a fungus bomb broke nearby, Nelson saw half a dozen Atlanteans tumble from their saddles, the hideous yellow growths already sprouting from nostrils, mouth, and ears. The turmoil became deafening, indescribable, like the roar of a crowded subway. The American had a brief glimpse of a mountainous Diplodocus assailed by half a dozen hissing, shrieking Allosauri, who, employing jaws and claws, ripped great shuddering chunks of flesh from the agonized and unwieldy monster on whose back the frantic Jarmuthians fought with terrible ferocity. As agile as grasshoppers, those fierce war-dogs ripped and worried their prey. One of them clung like a bulldog to the doomed Diplodocus's head, though the 20-foot neck writhed and whirled frantically in an effort to shake it loose. Another Allosaurus, whining with eagerness, actually clambered up the back of an assailed giant, only to fall back under the blast of a retortii mounted in the howdah. Bathed in live steam, with bones showing through its melting, quivering flesh, the Allosaurus collapsed backwards, but another instantly took its place, and gaining its goal with a terrific leap, made a shambles of the howdah, tearing the men in it apart as a lion does an antelope. Nelson found himself very busy. The charging Podokosos were now in the midst of the Jarmuthian heavy infantry, slashing down at a maze of yelling black-bearded Semitic faces. Once Nelson was nearly speared, shooting his assailant just as the lance glimmered over his heart. Again he saw the Atlantean hoplites beaten back amid a pestilential fog of fungus gas, which stretched them in kicking, loathsome heaps on the dusty plain. The uproar became terrific, indescribable, as the whistling streams of the Allosauri and the saurian bellows of the Diplodoci rose above the shouts of the soldiery to fill the dust-laden air with a dreadful clamor. The battle now swayed critically, a feather's weight on either side, and one army would roll back in red, irretrievable ruin. It was the psychological instant. Nelson sensed it unerringly. "Look!" shouted Hero John, dashing a rivulet of blood from his eyes. "There fights the dog-begotten Jeroboam himself, Haller Vann. Smite, ye soldiers of Atlans, smite!" Following the line of the outstretched hand, Nelson caught a glimpse of an enormous eagle-nosed warrior who, clad in gleaming diamond-studded harness, fought like a paladin of old. Powerful as a dark Ares, the sable-browed Jeroboam raged among the dismayed Atlantean hoplites, beating them to earth with terrible ferocity. It was a long shot, one he might readily have been forgiven in missing, but with the speed of thought, Victor Nelson sprang from his podoko, dropped on one knee behind a pile of corpses, and, uttering a fervent prayer, fired full at Jeroboam's black head. The nearest combatants drew back momentarily at the unfamiliar thunder of the report, and fell silent while the groans and shrieks of the wounded rose loud. As a man looking through many thicknesses of glass, so Nelson saw Jeroboam reel on his splendidly caparisoned podoko, clasp both hands to his forehead, and sink to earth. Hero Giles, somewhere far in the Atlantean van, saw what transpired, and capitalized it with the inspiration of a genius. "Jeroboam is dead!" he shouted in ringing tones, and flashed his red-stained sword. "Woe to Jarmuth this day! Smite, ye sons of Atlans! Woe to Jarmuth! Jeroboam is fallen!" And smite hard the reinforced Atlanteans did. Filled with a new courage, they advanced so determinedly that the disconcerted and dismayed Jarmuthians broke and fled in a disastrous, panic-stricken rout back over the plain of Poseidon towards the boiling river. The ground was already carpeted with dead and with abandoned equipment when fresh packs of allosauri were loosed on the fleeing Jarmuthians to wreak havoc indescribable, and ere long only the triumphant, panting Atlanteans remained on the field. End of chapter 5. Section 22 of Astounding Stories 14, February 1931, by Various. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Phalanxes of Atlans, by F. V. W. Mason. Chapter 6. There was music and high revelry in the fortress of Cierum that night, and Victor Nelson, embarrassed and flushed with the extravagant adoration of all Atlans, sat by the Emperor Altorius's side, waiting, watching for the appearance of a humbled Jarmuthian delegation. "Never since the world began has there been such a hero in Atlans," cried Altorius, his face more Roman than ever. "Prithee tarry amongst us, Hero Nelson. Thou shalt be as my brother. A marble palace shalt thou have, and 20 wives, each fair as those damsels which thou hast by thy might rescued from the profane altar of the fiend Beelzebub." "Thanks," laughed Nelson, and drained a goblet of tawny wine. "I'd be delighted to stay, but the point is—" He broke off short, for there came a sudden tramp of feet at the door of the great hall, and there, just visible above the green crests of the royal guards, he recognized that pale, drawn face which had haunted him ever since he had returned to find the abandoned aeroplane. "Dick!" he shouted. "Dick Alden!" "Nelson!" With that same irresistible form which had won a certain November classic for Harvard, Richard Alden bucked and plunged through a double rank of startled guards and came running across the marble floor, his eyes lit with an unspeakable gladness. "Nelson! Nelson!" he panted. "What in hell are you doing up there?" "Oh," replied the aviator with a joyous grin, "just visiting with my friend the Emperor." Alden halted, on his handsome features a curious mixture of surprise and delight. "The Emperor?" he stammered. "You sitting beside an Emperor?" "Would it not seem so?" inquired Altorius with a low laugh. "It would," chuckled Alden. "Victor Nelson, as I remember, always was a good politician." "And," thought Nelson, "I'll have to be a damn sight better one to get us out of Atlans without injuring Altorius's feelings. I don't suppose he'll ever be able to realize that all the desirable things in the world don't lie in this valley." Throngs of brilliantly armored and plumed officers and courtiers, some of them nursing wounds and bandaged heads, came up to hail the mighty wanderer who had subdued the might of Jarmuth. Flushed and pleased, as is any normal man under well-earned praise, Nelson shook one wiry fist after another while Alden chatted with the Emperor. Nobles, officers, and courtiers all pressed close to fawn upon the new hero, But, far back in the council chamber, a group of dark-robed priests were crowded together. Haranguing the priests was a fierce, white-bearded old man who seemed to be arguing violently. "Hm," thought the American. "That's at least one outfit that doesn't like the way I part my hair. Wonder what devilment the priests are cooking up." He was not long in finding out, for the black-robed archpriest suddenly left his group of underlings to boldly make his way forward, while princes, courtiers, and warriors drew respectfully aside and bent their heads. "Hail, all-conquering emperor!" The stern old man halted squarely before Altorius's gem-encrusted throne, while Alden checked some remark to look curiously down upon the hawk-featured archpriest. Altorius flushed, and the lines about his mouth tightened, from which Nelson guessed that there was more than a little bad blood between the spiritual and temporal heads of the empire. "What wouldst thou, O Heracles?" "I would know why the all-powerful wanderer, of whom thou makest so much, did not rescue Princess Altara." The emperor stiffened. "Her rescue, being impossible of accomplishment, was not nominated in the agreement," he said coldly. "The wanderer has in full carried out his share, and so shall we. Honored and beloved of Atlans, these great warriors shall abide among us in peace." Here Nelson thought it wise to dispel any illusions Altorius might entertain about their staying in Atlans. "No, O Splendor, remember our agreement was that should I conquer the Jarmuthian champions, Alden and I were to be allowed to go free." "Nay, O Splendor," fiercely broke in the archpriest, "permit them not to go. I tell thee the Princess Altara must be restored to Atlans, else evil days shall fall upon this empire, and the line of Hudson will wither and fade." Up sprang Altorius in a towering rage. "Sirrah, dost dare make threats to thy liege lord?" Fire flashed from the young emperor's bright blue eyes, and under their fierce glare the old man quailed and stepped back with eyes lowered. "The stranger shall go, though all the black-robed kites in the realm say me nay. The word of a Hudsonian prince is as sure as the fire of Pelion. Get thee gone, rash priest." A long moment the two strangely contrasting figures glared at each other, the young, splendid emperor and the malevolent, withered old man. "The gods demand their daughter," cried Heracles in parting, "and woe to him who says them nay." With this parting shot, the archpriest turned and, scarlet-faced, stalked from the council room, while Altorius threw back his head and roared with laughter. "Come, O ye heroes, ye princes and captains, come, let us make festival before these mighty wanderers go their way." Roar upon roar of enthusiasm echoed through the marble throne room, and Nelson would have felt wholly at ease had not that little knot of priests remained gathered like ill-omened carrion crows about the door. Muttering among themselves, they were watching him with a curious intentness that aroused deep misgivings in the American's mind, and it was with something like a sigh that he joined the procession forming to proceed to the triumphal feast on which the wealth and luxury of the whole empire of Atlans had been lavished. End of chapter 6. Story to be continued in the next issue. Section 23 of Astounding Stories 14, February 1931, by Various. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Pirate Planet, by Charles W. Diffin. Chapter 17. The little ship that Captain Blake had thrown with reckless speed through the skies over Washington, D.C., made history that day in the records of the Earth. None now could doubt that here, at last, was the answer that the world had hoped for until hope had died. Unbelievable in its field of action, incredible in its wild speed, but real nevertheless. The countries of the Earth were frantic in their acclaim. Only the men who formed the International Board of Defense failed to join in the enthusiasm. They sat by day and night in earnest conference on ways and means. This little ship, so wonderful and so inadequate, it was only a promise of what might come. There must be new designs made. Men must learn to dream in new terms and set down their dreams in cold lines and figures on drafting boards. A cruiser of space must be designed, to mount heavy guns, carry great loads, absorb the stresses that must come to such a structure in flight and in battle. And above all, it must take the thrust of this driving force, new and tremendous, of which men knew so little as yet. And then many like it must be built. The fuel must be prepared, and this alone meant new and different machinery, which itself must be designed before the manufacturing process could begin. There was work to be done, a world of work, and so few months in which to do it. The attack from the distant gun had long since ceased, and the instruments of the astronomers showed the enemy planet shrinking far off in space, but it would return. There was only a year for preparation. Captain Blake was assigned to the direction of design. An entire office building in Washington was vacated for his use, and in a few hours he rallied a staff of assistants who demanded the entire use of a telephone system that spread countrywide. And the call went out that would bring the best brains of the land to the task before them. The windows of the building shone brightly throughout the nights when the call was answered, and engineers and draftsmen worked at fever heat on thrusts and stresses and involved mathematical calculations. And while owners of great manufacturing plants waited with unaccustomed patience for a moment's talk with Blake, the white sheets on the drafting boards showed growing pictures of braces and struts and curved plates, of castings for gun mounts and ammunition hoists, and the manufacturers were told in no uncertain terms exactly what part of this experimental ship they would produce and when it must be delivered. "If only we dared go into production," said Blake. "But it is out of the question. This first ship must demonstrate its efficiency. We must get the bugs out of our design, correct our errors, and be ready with a production schedule that will work with precision." Only one phase of this proposed production troubled him. The manufacture must be handled all over the world. He talked with men from England and France, from Germany and Italy and a host of other lands, and he raged inwardly while he tried to drive home to them the necessity for handling the work in just one way, his way, if results were to be achieved. The men of business he could convince, but his chief disquiet came from those whose thoughts were of what they termed statesmanship, and who seemed more apprehensive of the power that this new weapon would give the United States of America than they were of the threat from distant worlds. From his friends in high quarters came hints of the same friction, but he knew that the one demand Winslow had laid down was being observed. The secret of the mysterious fuel would remain with us. Winslow had shown little confidence in the countries of the Old World, and he had sworn Blake to an agreement that his strange liquids, that new form of matter and substance, should remain with this country. And swiftly the paper ship grew. The parts were in manufacture and were arriving at the assembly plant in Ohio. Blake's time was spent there now, and he caught only snatches of sleep on a cot in his office, while he worked with the forces of men who succeeded each other to keep the assembly room going day and night. There was an enormous hangar that was designed for the assembling of a giant dirigible. It housed another ship now. Hardly a ship, yet it began to take form where great girders held the keel that was laid, and the duralumin plates and strong castings were bolted home. A thousand new problems and innumerable vexing errors, the bugs that inhere with a new mechanical job. Yet the day came when the ship was a thing of sleek beauty, and her thousand feet of length enclosed a maze of latticed struts, where ammunition rooms and sleeping quarters, a chart room, and control stations were cleverly interspaced. And above, where the great shape towered high in the big hangar, were the lean snouts of cannon, and recesses that held rapid-fire guns and whole batteries of machine guns for close range. Rows of great storage batteries were installed to furnish the first current for the starting of the ship, till her dynamos that were driven by the exhaust blast itself could go into action and carry on. And then an armored truck that ground slowly up under heavy guard to deliver two small flasks of liquid whose tremendous weight must be held in containers of thick steel, and be hoisted with cranes to their resting place within the ship, and Captain Blake, with his heart in his throat through fear of some failure, some slip in their plans, Captain Blake of the gaunt, worn frame, and face haggard from sleepless nights, stood quietly at a control board while the great doors of the hangar swung open. At the closing of a switch, the current from the batteries flowed through the two liquid to go on in conductors of heavy copper into a generator that was heavy and squat and devoid of moving parts. Within it were electrodes that were castings of copper, and between them the miracle of regenerated matter was taking place. What came to them as energy from the cables was transformed to a tangible thing, a vast bulk of gas, of hydrogen and oxygen that had once been water, and the pressure of the gas made a roaring inferno of the exhausts. A spark plug ignited it, and the heat of combustion added pressure to pressure, while the quivering, invisible, live steam poured forth to change to vaporous clouds that filled the hangar. The man at the control board stood trembling with the knowledge of the power he had unleashed. He moved a lever to crack open a valve, and the clouds poured now from beneath the ship that rose slowly and smoothly in the air. It hung quietly poised, while the hands that directed it sent a roaring blast from the great stern exhaust, and the creation of many minds became a thing of life that moved slowly, gliding out into the sunlight of the world. The cheers of crowding men, insane with hysterical emotion at sight of their work's fulfillment, were lost in the thunder of the ship. The blunt bow lifted where the sun made dazzling brilliance of her sweeping curves, and with a blast that thundered from her stern, the first unit of the space forces of the Earth swept upward in an arc of speed that ended in invisibility. No enveloping air could hold her now. She was launched in the ocean of space that would be her home. Captain Blake, the following day, sat in Washington before a desk piled high with telegrams of congratulation. His tired face was smiling as he replaced a telephone receiver that had spoken words of confidence and commendation from the President of the United States. But he pushed the mass of yellow papers aside to resume his examination of a well-thumbed folder marked Production Schedule. The real work was yet to be done. It was only 2 short months later that he sat before the same desk with a face that showed no mark of smiles in its haggard lines. His ship was a success, and was flying continuously while men of the air service were trained in its manipulation and gunners received practice in three-dimensioned range-finding and cruiser practice in the air. Above, in the airless space, they learned to operate the guns that were controlled from within the airtight rooms. They were learning, and the ship performed the miracles that were now taken as matters of fact. But production... Captain Blake rose wearily to attend a conference at the War Department. He had asked that it be called, and the entire service was represented when he reached there. He went without preamble or explanation to the point. "Mr. Secretary," he said, and faced the Secretary of War, "I have to report, sir, that we have failed. It is utterly impossible under present conditions to produce a fleet of completed ships. You know the reason. I have conferred with you often. It was a mistake to depend on foreign aid. They have failed us. I do not criticize them. Their ways are their own, and their own problems loom large to them. The English production of parts has come through or is proceeding satisfactorily. But the rest is in hopeless confusion. The Red menace from Russia is the prime reason, of course. With the Reds mobilizing their forces, we cannot blame her neighbors for preparing to defend themselves. But our program... and the sure invasion that will come in 6 short months, to be fighting among ourselves, it is damnable." He paused to stare in wordless misery at the silent gathering before him. Then, "I have failed," he blurted out. "I have fallen down on the job. It was my responsibility to get the cooperation that ensured success. Let me step aside. Is there anyone now who can take up the work and bring order and results from this chaos of futility?" He waited long for a reply. It was the Secretary of War who answered in a quiet voice. "We must not be too harsh," he said, "in our criticism of our foreign friends, but neither should we be unfair to Captain Blake. You do yourself an injustice. There is no one who could have done more than you. The reason is here." He struck at a paper that he held in his hand. "Europe is at war. Russia has struck without warning. Her troops are moving and her air force is engaged this minute in an attack upon Paris. It is a traitor country at home that has defeated us in our war with another world. I think," he added slowly, "there is nothing more that could have been done. You have made a brave effort. Let us thank you, Captain Blake, while we can. We will fight, when the time comes, as best we can. That goes without saying." A blue and gold figure arose slowly to speak a word for the Navy. It is evident by Captain Blake's own admission that the proposed venture must fail. It has been evident to some of us from the start. It was a fighter of the old school who was speaking. His voice was that of one whose vision has dimmed, who sees but the dreams of impractical visionaries in the newer inventions, and whose reliance for safety is placed only in the weapons he knows. "The naval forces of the United States will be ready," he told them, "and I would ask you to remember that we can still place dependence upon the ships that float in the water, and the forces who have manned them since the history of this country began." Captain Blake had sprung to his feet. Again he addressed the Secretary for War. "Mr. Secretary," he said, and there was a fighting glint in his eyes, "I make no reply to this gentleman. His arm of the service will speak for itself as it has always done, but your own words have given me new hope and new energy. I ask you, Mr. Secretary, for another chance. The industrial forces of the United States are behind us to the last man and the last machine. I have talked with them. I know. We have only 6 months left for a prodigious effort. Shall we make it? For the safety of our country and the whole world, let us attempt the impossible. Go ahead on our own. Turn the energy and the mind of this whole country to the problem. The great fleet of the world can never be. Shall we build and launch the great fleet of the United States and take upon our own shoulders the burden and responsibility of defense? It cannot be done by reasonable standards, but the time is past for reason. Possible or otherwise, we must do it. We will, if you will back me in the effort." There was a rising discord of excited voices in the room. Men were leaping to their feet to shake vehement fists in the faces of those who wagged their heads in protest. The Secretary of War arose to still the storm. He turned to walk toward the waiting figure of Captain Blake. "You can't do it," he said, and gripped the captain by the hand. "You can't do it, but you may. This country has seen others who have done the impossible when the impossible had to be done. It's your job. The President will confirm my orders. Go to it, Blake." End of chapter 17.